So this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Captain or Commander Randy Mays, recorded on March 23rd at Commander Mays's house, interviewed by Aaron O'Brien. And just for the record, can you state your rank and name?
Commander Randy Mays.
Okay, and do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. So, I thought I'd just start with some background information on you.
Mm-hmm.
When did you enroll or enlist in the Navy? And
September 1986.
Okay. And any particular reason for the Navy? Were you?
Well, my father was in the Navy.
Okay.
And I was always interested in going to sea.
Yeah.
Doing that sort of stuff. So I got to do a lot of that.
Okay. And so are you still with the Navy or have you retired?
I'm retired, but I work with students at the Naval Officer Training Center.
Okay.
Mentoring.
Okay, that's really cool. If you just kind of some early naval history, you know, what was the first ship you worked on? And
the first ship was, well, other than training, my first ship was HMCS Columbia, which was in the training squadron on the West Coast.
Okay.
And after that, I went to the commissioning crew for HMCS Algonquin.
Okay.
And a couple of little jobs. Did my course as an operations room officer. And then came back to the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
Served in two or three ships there. And squadron staff that I went to, the dreaded headquarters. And I worked in trainers and simulators. And then I worked for the chief of force development for 4 years. And then I came out and was, before that I went to staff college and I was the XO of McKenzie, and then came out and commanded. After that, I came out and commanded HMCS Huron. I went back to staff after that, and then was commanded HMCS Protector for. And what, 2 weeks after I took command, I went to East Timor.
Oh, wow. That must have been interesting.
It was a baptism of fire.
I can imagine. Okay, so I guess we'll get right in. So from my basic understanding, the crisis in Timor was after there was a referendum where the Timor people...
On the 31st of August, well, essentially, East Timor was a Portuguese colony,
mm-hmm.
enclave in Dutch Indonesia.
Yeah.
The Dutch pulled out after World War II, or were kicked out, and Indonesia started.
Mm-hmm.
And Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim country.
Okay, I actually didn't know that.
And it's true, 280 million people.
Oh, wow.
East Timor is Catholic.
Mm-kay.
Because of the
Portuguese. Mm-hmm.
So the Portugal pulled out and asked Indonesia to look after them.
Oh.
So a year after, they annexed it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the East Timorese were not very happy about that. Timor is about the size of Vancouver Island.
Oh, okay.
And it's divided into West Timor, which has always been part of Indonesia, mm-hmm. and East Timor, which isn't. So somewhere in here there's a map.
Okay.
Right there.
All right.
So, East Timor,
mm-hmm.
West Timor, and East Timor has a little enclave called Mbino.
Okay.
Here, enclave. So, the Timorese fought, and they actually, there was an expatriate group that went to Australia,
mm-hmm.
and they were very smart. and tech savvy,
mm-hmm.
and they started winning the battle with Indonesia, mm-hmm. about the annexation of East Timor. They started winning the technical battle, or the battle of for world opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And over the space of 10 years or so, they started to really hurt Indonesia.
Yeah.
In the sense that Indonesia was highly dependent on technical support and assistance from the United States and other countries. And that was drying up because of East Timor. So they decided to have a referendum
mm-hmm.
for independence. And I'm quite convinced that personally that they didn't ever believe that anybody would want to leave Indonesia. But they... the Kopassus, which is the Indonesian secret police or special forces, rather, part of the army, started funding little groups, militias they called themselves, who started, when they decided to have the referendum, which occurred on the 31st of August, 30th of August, I'm not sure, 31st or 30th of August, 1999, they started intimidating people
mm-hmm.
and roaring around in jeeps with guns and things and intimidating people. So not everybody turned out to vote, and they only voted about 89% mm-hmm. for independence.
Okay.
It would have been quite a bit higher, apparently, according to the people who know, if a few hadn't been intimidated. However, on the 1st of September, these militias and Indonesians started destroying the country because they were in a SNIP. Mm. And they destroyed the country.
Yeah.
They, in the end, they took about, I think, 200,000 and deported them.
Oh, my goodness.
The military, of course, had nothing to do with this,
mm-hmm.
but they went in military transport vessels.
Okay.
And they were taken to West Timor and up into these islands.
Okay.
Another 250 to 300,000 were forced into the hills.
Mm-hmm.
So 600,000 people were displaced, one way or another. And they destroyed the country.
Oh, wow.
They burned everything they could.
Okay.
What they couldn't burn, they smashed. And it was quite amazing. So, after Rwanda,
mm-hmm.
the United Nations was quite willing to do something. And Australia was very interested in what goes on up there, because it's quite close, actually.
Mm-hmm.
To Australia. So Australia led a coalition to sort this out. And when the forces got there, there were actually, people were still burning the country.
Oh, wow.
When the Australian forces got there.
Oh, my goodness.
The Australian website, I don't have a copy of it, but they have a picture of a soldier crouched with... sort of eyes as big as saucers, with people burning buildings all around them.
Oh my goodness.
So anyway, the level of destruction was astounding.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, on the 10th of, I think it was the 10th September, the Australians started moving in, and I was warned on Sunday that we were already a high readiness vessel, so we were told that we were going to sail in 10 days.
Oh, wow.
For East Timor.
Mm-hmm.
But we were told unofficially, because the government hadn't actually announced it yet.
Okay.
So they didn't announce it till Wednesday, but we were hard at work.
Mm-hmm.
So we offloaded all of our ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
The ship has a four-story magazine.
Okay.
with a hoist and so forth that carries ammunition. So we offloaded all of our naval ammunition and loaded a bunch of stuff for the army that was going to be there. There was an air bridge established with two Canadian air bridge with two Canadian Hercules, and in Suai down here, they sent in the Royal 22nd sent
okay,
in a
the
yeah sent okay. in an augmented company, they called it.
Okay.
So there was a company but with engineers and things that they normally wouldn't have to allow them to support themselves. So and they were in Suai under the command of New Zealand Army battalion that was there.
Okay.
So they were actually further up, a little bit away from Suai. So that was the whole, and also a headquarters unit, which was based on Dili,
okay.
The capital. So we went down, we sailed 10 days later,
mm-hmm.
and we sailed on Friday with a workup team on board. We had spent the whole 10 days, normally you get 2 or 3 months to get ready for workups.
Oh, wow.
We had 10 days of 16-hour days to get ready to go to sea.
Mm-hmm.
We had no time to worry about workups. So, other than that, I had one thing that I insisted on, which is that everybody got one working day off to go and sort out their lives.
Yeah.
So anyway, we went off and we sailed with the workups team on board. We had no idea what we were sailing into. There was still combat going on. The anchorage around Dili is quite close to the Timorese, or to West Timor,
mm-hmm.
where there's an Indonesian, and there was Indonesian Navy all through here.
Oh, wow.
And there was still combat going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't know what we were getting into. So we basically slept for the weekend, spent 3 or 4 days getting ready for workups, and then started into workups. So
okay.
we worked up all the way to Hawaii, but we couldn't actually, and we were going as fast as we could.
Mm-hmm.
We sailed with, we got a bunch of stuff from the army, most of which was totally useless. we actually found some of the stuff that was useless. Because some quartermaster had said, give these people the standard support for company. So we went through a little bit of it. Most of it was packaged up. We couldn't see what was in it. But we did send back the snowshoes and the winter parkas and sleeping bags and that sort of stuff. We sent all that back. But we missed the wheels and tires for vehicles that weren't going to be there, all that sort of stuff. So we went down and we sailed at full speed.
Mm-hmm.
Which was quite rare. We had we were completely loaded with fuel, with as many supplies as we could carry, and we sailed. It took us at 20 knots, which was our full speed. It took about a month
okay.
to get there.
Oh.
And the workup staff stayed with us past Hawaii because it took them longer than that, because of course we wasted a week of their time sleeping and getting ready for them.
Mm-hmm.
So they sailed with us, which was great, because once they'd finished working us up, they were very cooperative and helpful. Anyway, then we arrived in Darwin.
Okay.
Operation
Toucan?
It was Operation Toucan, so that was our mascot. That's the Air Force unit.
Oh, okay.
That's what the Army ended up driving.
Oh, okay.
All of which was supplied by diesel, because that's all there was.
Mm-hmm.
It was diesel. And that was us in the anchorage.
Oh, okay.
in Dilley. No, I don't have a lot of shots of Darwin. Anyway, this is what we went. We got into Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing we did was run into the New Zealand tanker. Very small little tanker. Mm-hmm. That was just coming out of there. So they said, "Well, we've got a bunch of fuel. We don't need." So they came alongside and gave us fuel.
Oh wow!
Because we came in, we were at anchor. Darwin was the headquarters of it, the base that everybody operated from.
Okay.
Because the way Australia is set up, there's Darwin in the north west.
Okay.
There's a giant jungle,
mm-hmm.
Swamp that's 800 miles by 500 miles.
Oh, my goodness.
So, and the nearest big town is Adelaide, which is over here.
Okay.
So everything had to come out of Darwin.
All right.
Darwin is the Australian word for Prince Rupert.
Oh.
It's about the same size.
Okay.
It's got a great harbor full of saltwater crocodiles. And a fairly small port.
Mm-hmm.
So we operated out of there. Got alongside, offloaded all our useless army stuff, and the contingent, the headquarters contingent that was there just rented a warehouse to put it in.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave us enough room to actually do our job,
okay.
Which was to resupply other ships. And we loaded up again with fuel. The Australians paid for all the fuel. Took off for for Dilley.
Okay.
Now Dilley was about 24 hours at full speed.
Okay.
From Darwin. So we got to Dilley, and came to anchor. This is a Italian disaster relief vessel.
Okay.
It's designed for disaster relief. It's got great big boats. And helicopters.
Okay.
And a well deck to move them in and out.
Mm-hmm.
We had two helicopters with us. And that's what Dilley looked like when we got there. It looks really nice, doesn't it?
Yeah, actually kind of reminds me of home. I'm from the Okanagan, mm-hmm. just the mountain
scape.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, once you got closer, it wasn't quite the same.
Oh,
so
dear.
We went ashore in our boats.
Okay.
And that's what it looked like.
Oh, my goodness.
So all of this concrete was perished because it was all heated up.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
So we went, when we went ashore, this was the kind of thing we saw.
Oh my goodness.
And we found out later how it was done. In Dilley, we did some... One of the useful things that we did there was we got involved with some NGOs.
Okay.
And we did relief stuff. We built schools and stuff.
Okay.
And one of the things we did was we worked with a group that was setting up a reception center. The idea was that as the people came back to Dilley, they would come into the reception center, they'd be sort of kitted out, and within a couple of days they'd go back. They'd be, go on to the economy and more people would come in.
Okay.
And this was in a warehouse that basically all there was the roof, the metal roof, and
mm-hmm.
some pylons to hold it up. There was no walls around it, so we put some light walls in, that sort of stuff. But it was just a mess on this big concrete pad. So we called in the fire truck to hose it all off for us, and people panicked. They ran away.
Oh, my goodness.
because the militias and the Indonesian forces had taken the fire trucks, filled them with gas.
Oh my!
And they hosed down the building, light it up, go to the next one.
Oh wow! Oh my goodness!
So shortly after we got there, General Cosgrove, who was the Australian commander of the force, came aboard to speak to the troops.
Okay.
And we started doing our regular work, which was to replenish all the ships.
Okay.
Or as many ships as we could of the forces that were there.
Okay. What other forces were there?
I think I have something here. There were most of the forces that were there were Australian.
Okay.
We relieved an Australian tanker that was there, and he went off for a refit. But we had Italians. There was an American amphibious assault ship that was there. That was the Americans never put any people ashore.
Okay.
Except that they did a lot of support work. So they had a liaison officer within the headquarters, but most of their stuff was behind the scenes. It was logistics support. This group that was out there was there waiting in case they were needed, but they weren't. So they never actually, their aim was not to get involved in a an active role.
Okay.
And there were Singaporeans, Thais, Malaysians, who else? Kiwis. Ourselves, Portuguese, of course. Portuguese colony, so there was the Vasco da Gama from Portugal was there.
Yeah.
And more will occur to me. So we started doing replenishments at sea. There was the Canterbury, an old Leander class frigate from the from the British forces was there.
Okay.
She's gone now. Been replaced by more modern things. This is the American.
Oh, okay.
Amphibious assault ship. That was the French. The French were there.
Okay.
That's the. They were in a lot of trouble. We sent them some Freon because they had, because she was an old ship, they'd lost their air conditioning. They had to have no air conditioning in the ship.
Oh my goodness.
For a week and a half.
Oh my gosh.
I have to wonder if they could stand up.
Yeah.
Vasco da Gama is the Portuguese. That was a lifesaver.
Really?
Yeah. That is a... an Australian catamaran fast ferry.
Okay.
And in fact, there's one of these running between Bar Harbor, Maine, and Yarmouth, Nova Scotia right now. They're a wonderful piece of kit.
Really?
In flat water, they'll go 45 knots.
Oh, wow.
They would make the trip from East Timor, from Darwin, in 9 to 10 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
So, and they... just through luck to support industry, they'd been forced to accept one of these into the Navy, and it was a lifesaver.
Oh, wow.
Because they carried an awful lot of freight very quickly and people back and forth.
Oh, wow.
They made the trip, I think, 3 times a week.
Okay.
And we replenished them. We fueled them. That was tricky. But our main job, our most important job, was to be the fuel dump.
Oh, okay.
For we were the fuel, the entire fuel supply for East Timor.
Oh, wow.
For all the forces in East Timor.
Oh, my goodness.
Everything ran on diesel, except the airplanes, which ran on, most of them ran on diesel too, but on aviation fuel, which we also had. So we developed a plan. And these, well, we'd inherited it actually from the Australian ship that was there. But we had some special fittings, and they would, these things would come alongside with tanker trucks.
Okay.
And we would fill up the tanker trucks. Now, when you're used to filling a ship, which takes everything you can give them at 80, 90 PSI.
Okay.
You can't fill one of those at that.
Oh, wow.
So we had to develop a plan, a way to get it down to about what you use, a little more than what you use to fill up your car.
Okay.
And the first time we did it, it didn't work very well, so we had a spill. And it was so hot there that we couldn't find the fuel 50 yards down because it had all evaporated into the air.
Oh, my goodness.
It was so hot.
Oh, wow.
The water was warm. So that's how we did it. These are the fuelies.
Oh, okay.
Now, the Australians had a bit of a problem because they had privatized almost all of their logistics.
Oh, okay.
They had one company of fuel technicians.
Okay.
That one company of 50 or 100 fuel technicians in uniform did all of the fuel support for the entire island.
Oh, my goodness.
Every fuel dump was them. Those guys, I've never seen anybody work that hard. So that's what we would do. Just one after the other. Fill them up. And we tried and tried and tried because they were so busy they couldn't even see themselves think. We tried and tried and tried to find out how much fuel they had ashore, how big their fuel dump really was.
Yeah.
And somewhere in the end of all this, so that was our, you know, in the war they used to paint ship aircraft on the side of guns.
Oh, okay.
So that was our fuel tanks, fuel trucks. Every X is 10 trucks.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense, Roman numerals.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the aircraft was flying around.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Having a look at the country.
Yeah.
So, down in Suai, where the army was, there was no port. So everything went over the beach.
Okay.
This is a beach road.
Oh.
Mesh road. Unfortunately, that truck, that tanker is seriously stuck.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Took them 2 days to get rid of it.
Oh, my gosh.
But our helicopter was flying around to see what was up when they weren't replenishing people and doing things like that. Yep. This is Christmas. So we were there for Christmas.
Okay.
And the family support at home, we turned them loose on the problem because the people, we were building these schools and the people had nothing. They had no paper.
Oh, wow.
Never mind books. So from home, the families put together care packages.
Okay.
And the care packages would be a big plastic bag with paper, pencils, basic toiletries,
okay,
a few clothes, and one small gift.
Aww.
We We couldn't ship it like that because customs wouldn't allow us. So they had we had to build it all.
Oh, wow.
These guys are making packages. So we ended up with 600 of them.
Oh, my goodness.
So we sent Santa Claus ashore. Unfortunately, Santa Claus is not part of the tradition. Okay. This was the cathedral.
Oh, my gosh.
So in front of the cathedral, there's a small, there's a burned spot about the size of this tablecloth.
Okay.
Where six priests were burned.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, we sent Santa Claus ashore and, before the Christmas Mass, Christmas Eve Mass, and they gave away all these packages.
Okay. So were the priests burned because they were Catholic?
Because they were priests.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. There were sort of interesting stories. We
I can imagine.
Near Dili, there's a really nice beach that we used to go on, on our little time off and go for a swim. And the local story was that the Kopassus forces had fed a crocodile.
Oh, wow.
And one of the reasons there were no bodies was that they were fed to the crocodile.
Oh, my goodness.
So anyway, so that was sort of exciting to do that. And also we spent Christmas around Suai. The chief of defense staff was there, who was army. And we had the entire army for Christmas dinner.
Oh, wow.
In shifts.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole 130 of them came for Christmas dinner.
Oh, wow. That's nice.
And shortly after that, we had, or around that time, we also hosted these guys, which were band and sort of show. Show tour.
Okay.
This is a little while. Oh, this is the foreshore of Dili.
Okay.
And the kids, you can't keep kids down.
Yeah. Was that barbed wire up there?
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
That was to, actually to protect the port.
Okay.
That was razor wire put up by
okay.
the Australian forces to keep people from pilfering all the stuff off.
Okay, so that was actually used against the Indonesian forces.
Well, no. It was used against anybody who...
Okay.
Because, I mean, when you got nothing.
Yeah.
And these guys got everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, the talk about crocodiles. Yeah. They took 100 of those every year out of... they take 100 of those every year out of Dili Harbor.
Oh my gosh.
They will grow to 20 feet long. Come 6 feet out of the water, and have been known to take people out of boats.
Oh my gosh.
So this is actually one of our school projects.
Okay.
And that's the school we're roofing it, just with tarps, but getting it done. That was actually one of the best days I ever spent.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I wasn't in this picture, but I was up on the roof.
Okay.
And of course, the people who knew what they were doing up there were having a great time ordering the cap around. So this is the end result.
Okay.
Again, a nun.
Oh, wow.
And we also flew supplies, supplied by the NGOs, into small mountain communities that just weren't getting anything from anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of stuff that was there when we got there. It was death to Indonesia.
Okay.
And that's what was...
Oh, wow.
So INDOFET was the International Force of East Timor.
Mm-hmm.
This was a little earlier, actually. This was Halloween.
Okay. So are they dressed in costume? Or?
No, they were the medics.
Oh, okay.
They were dressed as condoms.
Oh! I did not get that. I was thinking white ninjas.
No, you had to kind of be there.
Okay.
Hey, this is our guys ashore.
Okay.
This is Darwin.
Oh, wow.
Very modern city.
Mm-hmm.
It was completely destroyed in 1964.
Really?
By a huge hurricane.
Oh, my goodness.
This is the commander of the forces, now retired Rear Admiral.
Okay.
Roger Joie.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Freddy.
Okay.
Who was the mascot of Fredericton.
Oh, okay.
On the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
Canadian Patrol frigate. And Freddy was kidnapped.
Oh, no.
And sent to one of my officers. So Freddy had lots of adventures.
Oh, my
in
goodness.
In East Timor. You know, we all had armbands with mm-hmm. the Interfet pass patch and our country's flag on it.
Okay.
And he had one. And he was, he really got around, that guy. He got into a lot of trouble. And we religiously kept a diary and pictures of what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the Vasco da Gama was going to go back to Portugal and then join the NATO naval standing force.
Mm-hmm.
And Fredericton was supposed to come and join the NATO standing force. So we were going to actually have him go around the world. But I decided that that was just a little risky.
Yeah.
Because we wouldn't want Freddy not to make it back.
Yeah.
So we took Freddy back with us and sent him back.
Oh, wow.
This is the countryside. This is what it looked like.
Oh, my gosh.
These buildings, many of them were houses.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing there. They were all built above the ground because in the rainy season, it rains there 6 inches every day before noon.
Oh, my gosh.
And so they're all on, but there was nothing there but the concrete pad and a few burn posts.
Oh, wow.
And the people were actually living in tents behind it.
Oh, my gosh.
Behind these houses. And that's when we left.
Oh, okay. Wow.
The same place.
Oh, my gosh. It looks almost kind of like an aerial shot of a suburb.
Mm-hmm. That was a picture on a Christmas card. That's in Darwin Harbor.
Okay.
Anyway.
Okay. Wow.
So those are the we were there. We started back in February. We were there, I think, 25 days longer than anybody else.
Oh,
any
wow.
other ship at all.
Oh, my goodness.
Of any force.
Wow.
And it was great. The crew was superb.
Mm-hmm.
One of the nice things about having a ship like that is if it breaks, you can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
So we never missed a commitment. But they worked manfully to keep her going.
Yeah.
Whereas the new ones, if it breaks, you have to replace something. You know, you have to actually fly an engine out.
Mm-hmm.
But the old steam, you know, you can just, with a big wrench, you can fix a lot of stuff. I had all the stats at one stage. But we ran through, I guess, about 9 full cargoes.
Oh, wow.
And a full cargo is 1 million liters of fuel.
Oh, my goodness.
And 600,000 liters of aviation fuel.
Oh, my goodness.
And we replenished. Basically, we kept East Timor running.
Mm-hmm.
As I said before that we wanted to find out how much fuel they had aboard.
Yeah.
We planned to go away, to go back to Darwin to refuel.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to come back. It's a shorter run to Suai.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's another day's run around to Dili. So we were going to down, have 2 days of R&R, and while we refueled. Came back, come back, go to Suai, support the army for a day or two, come around. And that was going to take us 8 days.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked him and asked him and asked him. And one day the Commodore, the British Commodores, or the Australian Commodores, of course, not being campers, would come out and visit us, spend the night when we were in Harbour. We spent most of our time at anchor, actually, in Dili.
Mm-hmm.
We would sail at night. In the day, we'd transfer fuel. We'd sail at night and fuel people, and then come back to anchor in the morning. We went. He finally came and said, about 3 days before we were supposed to leave, and said, "I have some news for you that you might not like." He said, "Their actual strategic fuel supply is 6 days."
Okay.
So there were going to be 2 days with no fuel. Oh, if we went away for 8 days.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow.
So we didn't do that.
Yeah.
We just went down. We would be away for 5 days because we'd go down, or 4 days. We'd go down. It would take us a day to get to Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
Spend 2 days fueling and giving everybody some time off. And then head back up.
Okay.
So Darwin gets a little old after a few times because it's small. Mm-hmm. And the nearest town of any size is Alice Springs, and it's 1,400 miles.
Oh, okay. Wow.
It took us a little time to get people in Canada to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Because the supply people in Ottawa and sent all our spare parts and things that we'd ordered when we first got there, they'd arrived. Mm-hmm. And we thought, that's great. We got there and no stuff, no mail.
Oh, wow.
Nothing. So, called back and said, "Well, where's our stuff?" And they said, "Oh, well, it's in Townsville. That's pretty close." I said, "Okay. Let's put this in terms you might understand. You've sent it to Regina. We're in Prince Rupert, and there's no train." Because between those two places that are about the distance of Regina and Prince Rupert apart,
mm-hmm.
there is 500 miles deep, 900 miles wide swamp.
Oh my gosh.
So everything has to go, there's no train, everything has to go by truck south 1,000 miles.
Oh my gosh.
To Alice Springs, that's 2,000 miles, then to Alice Springs. Then north 1,400 miles to Darwin.
Oh my gosh.
They run truck trains. Monster trucks with cabs
mm-hmm.
with 8 pups.
Oh, okay.
Because these roads are just as straight as an arrow for
mm-hmm.
1,000 miles.
Oh my goodness.
It's worse than the prairies.
Can imagine that would have been fun to deal with.
Well, It was interesting. Eventually they started flying stuff into Darwin because there was just no sensible way to do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
There's just nowhere near.
Okay.
Therefore, we couldn't go anywhere else.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have time.
Yeah. Was there a reason why they weren't flying it into Darwin to begin with?
Well, because Darwin was pretty busy.
Okay.
I mean, it was the staging area for all of East Timor.
Okay.
You know, getting stuff into Darwin took some scheduling. But it was the only way.
Yeah.
Because there's just no reasonable alternative. Everything is a long way from Darwin.
Okay. Okay. And so you guys did like a lot of the extra work aside from like being the logistics coordinator. You did a lot of work like in Timor, like the humanitarian. Like,
yeah,
building.
We did a lot of humanitarian building. We got involved with several NGOs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the most rewarding thing we did.
Yeah.
The most important thing we did was to provide stability. When we got there, by the way, there was no battle going on. It was over.
Oh, okay.
But after, just as we left Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
the Australian forces actually forced an Indonesian submarine to surface in our anchorage.
Oh, wow.
So we didn't know even then what we were facing.
Yeah.
But by the time we got to Darwin, it was all over with the shouting.
Mm-hmm.
They, the Indonesian army didn't actually leave until about 2 weeks after we got there.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't doing anything. They were pretty much bottled up by the Australian forces.
Okay. Oh, wow.
But the people started coming back, and 500,000 people coming back, coming down from the hills and coming back to East Timor from West Timor and from the islands around, was a pretty daunting task.
I can imagine.
And the NGOs got pretty involved.
Yeah. Okay, so I know you mentioned working with schools and stuff. Did you guys work with hospitals or medical supplies as
well? Not very much. We carried, the supplies we carried up into the hills were medical and food and building supplies and all sorts of things. We didn't do a huge amount of that, but what we did, we certainly got a lot of credit for.
Okay.
The most rewarding things we did were things like roofing schools and building that reception center, that sort of stuff, working with people. We also sent our people ashore to help out the headquarters,
mm-hmm.
who were living in a burned out building.
Oh my goodness.
So we sent our the hull technicians in a ship,
mm-hmm.
can do anything.
Oh wow.
They're like the riggers or the millwrights in a mill. They handle HVAC. They handle construction. They build. They handle damage control. They do firefighting. They do. They can use. They can build with wood, they can build with metal,
mm-hmm.
they can do just about anything.
Oh, wow.
So those guys went ashore, electricians, wired it up, and the people ashore really appreciated the fact that they actually had a civilized place to live.
Mm-hmm.
We were lucky because we were at sea, we didn't get a lot of disease. There was a fair amount of disease ashore.
Oh, really?
Well, there was dengue and things like that.
Oh, wow.
The army guys reported, I think, 24 scorpion bites in the first week.
Oh, my gosh.
And then it stopped because, A, they learned to shake out their boots in the morning, and, B, they learned that they weren't going to die, so they stopped reporting it. It was like a super bee sting.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting place. I mean, about 80% of the things that can kill you live in that part of the country, of the world.
Oh, gosh.
So there's fish. There's octopus that can kill you.
Oh.
There's sea snakes that if they ever bit, they have little tiny mouths. They probably couldn't bite you, but if they ever did, you'd never get out of the water.
Oh, my gosh.
And they're everywhere.
Really?
Yeah. But they have little tiny mouths. They could only bite you there.
Oh, okay.
They're 8 feet long, but they just have little tiny mouths. So there's all kinds of stuff that was interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
Not a place you want to swim.
No.
For any distance. So, you know, we spent a lot of time warning people about things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know. As I said, they took 100 of those crocodiles that you saw out of Darwin Harbor
year. Oh, my goodness.
So, because they live up around where they're throughout that area.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of interesting, but mostly it was about just keeping people's spirits up and we were lucky. We didn't lose hardly anybody.
That's good. How did you find the people's, like, the Timorese people's attitudes towards the Canadian troops?
Well,
just the troops in general?
The day I went ashore to work on the roof, we were going back in an Australian three or four open trucks,
mm-hmm.
and it was the rainy season. So we went back in a pounding rainstorm in mm-hmm. open trucks.
Oh, fun.
I mean, it was like it bounces that far off the ground.
Oh my gosh.
And people were coming out of their hovels behind their where their houses used to be to cheer us.
Oh wow.
So the people, the people were really tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
And their resources were amazing. I went ashore with to meet a friend who was ashore, who belonged to an NGO, a guy I'd known for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And we went for dinner about 2 weeks before I left
mm-hmm.
at a restaurant. And it was an open-air restaurant,
mm-hmm.
but it was a restaurant that was operating.
Yeah.
And out of nothing. They had a society going
mm-hmm.
out of nothing. So
oh, wow.
They were quite amazing people.
Yeah.
And they really appreciated the fact that we saved them from these monsters that
yeah.
just were determined to destroy the country.
Oh, my goodness.
And everybody in it.
Yeah. Wow.
Unfortunately, things haven't panned out all that well because, of course, once the community, once the world moves on, the aid dries up and there's a lot of unemployment. So it's, from that point of view, it's a bit unfortunate, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, you knew that was going to happen.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Was this one of your first international missions, or?
It was my only mission to I've served overseas.
Okay.
But it was the only operational mission I was ever on.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I think we've covered almost everything. I know you really enjoyed doing the humanitarian work and working with the schools and everything and the different traditions. And I know you said that Santa Claus wasn't a part of the Catholic tradition there. So how did
it wasn't part of the culture there.
Oh, okay. So not how did the kids react to Santa Claus?
Well, they were a bit mystified until actually the priests explained.
Okay.
But they sort of got into the spirit of it and they certainly appreciated the gifts.
Oh, wow.
Not to mention that there was a lot of candy. That picture is out not of him giving out gifts, but of candy.
Oh.
But anyway, their culture is more Indonesian because they're sort of the same kind of people
mm-hmm.
than their faith.
Oh, okay.
The same as Indonesians are, they're Muslims, but they're not Muslims in the same way that the Arab Muslims are.
Oh, okay.
Because their culture is different.
Mm-hmm.
And the Afghan Muslims are different again.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's a matter of how their culture works. And they just didn't have a Santa Claus in their in their world.
Yeah.
For instance, I was very lucky actually because before I went on this, I did a 3-month course in Hawaii at the Asia Pacific Center for Defense Studies,
mm-hmm.
for Strategic Studies, an American school that with an international group. And I learned a lot about the Indonesians because I said things about Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
And the admiral that was the chief Indonesian would send a colonel, who actually had been the head of the Secret Service, to straighten me out. So he'd take me off to lunch, straighten me out. And I also did a project on international maritime law.
Okay.
Which was very useful because Indonesia is a particular case in international maritime law. It's the world's only pelagic nation.
Okay.
Or not pelagic. Archipelagic Nation.
Okay.
So I learned some stuff that was very useful to me.
Well, that's good.
Because I actually had to go through Indonesian waters to get to somewhere else. Okay. To get to that little enclave.
Yeah.
Because they had ships off there and I had to go and replenish them.
Okay.
But anyway, I learned things like when two Indonesian men will hold hands.
Mm-hmm.
And all it means in Indonesia is, we're having a private conversation, don't interrupt us.
Oh. That's interesting.
Yeah. So, different culture.
Yeah.
It was very interesting to see the similarities and the differences between the two cultures.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most hated things in Delhi was the Indonesians had put up a statue of Jesus. They had made East Timor the 17th province of Indonesia.
Okay.
And they took it over.
Mm-hmm.
The thing was precisely 17 meters high.
Okay.
For that reason.
Wow.
That's why it was hated.
Oh, okay. I was going to say.
Not because it was Jesus, but because
of. I was going to say, I thought they were Catholic.
Yeah, but it was
a
symbol.
It represented
the domination by Indonesia.
Okay, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so a lot of sort of little nuances that you got to know.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I know you also mentioned earlier about the Australian privatized their fuel. Did you ever?
Not just fuel, their whole logistic train. They didn't have very many military people.
Was there a specific reason for that, or?
Save money.
Okay.
Civilians are cheaper than military people by a significant margin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they contracted out a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, because, again, they were trying to save money.
Okay.
And it very nearly sank them. Without mm-hmm. the Americans, they'd have been toast.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I got a lot of very silly things about my fuel. Had to send fuel samples back to somebody or other in Australia.
Interesting.
And I got increasingly strident demands for these.
Mm-hmm.
Which I never did.
Yeah.
I just, when it got too painful, I just sent it off to headquarters for advice. National Defense Headquarters for advice.
Yeah.
And they went back to Australia and said, excuse me, not an Australian ship.
Yeah.
Don't bother us anymore.
Okay. So when you left East Timor, did you leave with a better feeling than when you had arrived?
Or? Oh, yeah. We it was a great thing. It was a great thing for the ship, for the people.
Mm-hmm.
We all felt that we'd done something useful.
Okay.
As I say, the most satisfying thing we did, of course, was the humanitarian stuff. But the
mm-hmm.
most important stuff we did, more important stuff we did, was to provide some stability
mm-hmm.
for the people and to basically save them from the Indonesian wrath. It was really funny. It was totally illogical the way they, to us.
Mm-hmm.
The reaction to the referendum.
Wanting independence?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they got to meet some of the movers and shakers
mm-hmm.
in that group, one of whom later became the president, the first president, and the second president I met. But they sort of traded back and forth for a while.
Okay.
Because there was nobody else, really. There were no political parties. There was a government in exile, but really no infrastructure to build on. There was no
mm-hmm.
There was no police. There was no judiciary. There were no laws.
Mm-hmm.
They were basically building a nation from the ground up.
Okay.
And they got a lot of help from the Australians to do that.
Mm-hmm. Another aspect of the humanitarian work I read that occurred was there's a creation of a police school there.
Yes, we helped them out too.
Mm-hmm.
We actually sent our I forgot about that. We sent our people ashore to do what we'd done for the headquarters.
Okay.
We did to the RCMP school.
Okay.
So we put up gyprock and wired it and so forth. They had a school for police.
Mm-hmm.
There were, I don't know how many of them there were. I met five or six, but there were more than that.
Oh, wow.
RCMP went down to help build a police.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have laws. I mean, there was a whole nation that started from nothing.
Oh, wow.
They kind of had the Indonesian laws, which were not, I mean, they're not terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But they had no laws of their own. They had no, certainly had no judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
Or lawyers. They had some lawyers come back who had been trained in Australia, but they didn't really have a whole legal system
mm-hmm.
from the police up. So the RCMP did a lot for that.
Okay. So how did being a part of the East Timor operation affect your I want to essentially say naval career, but it affected you, like, after you came home.
After I came home, it was sort of, it was personally very satisfying. It was, of course, tough on the families.
Mm-hmm.
But life has changed. I mean, the first time I went to sea for a long time, you know, you were lucky. You know, I got a telegram when my first son was born.
Oh.
Whereas there,
mm-hmm.
there were a great many computers. I think for 300 people, we had about 175 computers.
Okay.
350 people. And so people could get on and connect with their families, mm-hmm. which was a good and bad thing because there were a lot of rumors going both ways.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the rumors came from ashore.
Oh, wow.
And I would sort of hear that. Somebody, so-and-so was talking, was texting with their family or emailing with their family, and I found this stuff out. We had video conferencing. The Military Family Resource Center Christmas party, they set up a video conference that ran on for about 20 hours.
Oh, wow.
So we had one of the first things that the Australians put up in Dili was mm-hmm. a cell tower.
Oh, okay.
Australia was, even then, one of the biggest countries in the world for cell. Australia is one zone.
Oh, wow.
So you can phone anywhere in Australia, it's a local call.
Oh my goodness.
And you could phone from East Timor, was a local call.
Really?
So you could buy in Darwin, you could buy a card,
mm-hmm.
A prepaid phone card, and there was a number you could call, and you could just charge more time on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody who wanted to, when we were at anchor, we had a period in the evening where anybody who wanted to could use a cell phone and call home.
Oh, wow.
So it was very different.
Yeah. No, it sounds very different from mm-hmm. when my dad would go overseas and,
yeah,
you know, we'd be so excited to get a letter from him.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah. Being 30 days without mail was frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't the end of the world.
And you still had other means of communication.
You still had connection.
Okay.
So it was quite incredible, mm-hmm. the amount of connection that we had. And a lot of that has to do with that we've sent so many people into the Gulf.
Okay.
And places like that, that they've had to improve
mm-hmm.
connection. I mean, we've had more people in harm's, or in operations areas than at any time since more naval people than since the Second World War.
Oh, wow.
So it's starting with the first Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
After the Gulf War, we send in ships.
Okay.
Including Preserver. Went there.
Okay. Okay. And I know we're kind of jumping around here, but back, mm-hmm. you said your favorite day, or one of your favorite moments, was working on the roof mm-hmm. of the school. Is there any reason why? Or?
Well, just because that was the only time I really got ashore to actually do
okay.
the humanitarian stuff, okay. as opposed to just sort of sorting it out and getting, you know, getting it arranged and getting
organizing
people.
Organizing it.
Yeah, and okay. getting people, you know, sending people off to do it. So it was the first time that I'd actually managed to get ashore and do it myself. So that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, the guys who were having the most fun were the guys down below telling me what to do.
Okay, well, I think that's everything I have to ask right now.
Okay.
So this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Commander Mays on March 23rd. Thank you very much for your
time. Thank you. You're welcome.